What's up, sports fans? Welcome to Sports Odds and Ends, the show for the fly-by-night sports fan. I'm King Kaz. I'm joined by my good co-host, the great JVZ.
Good to be back.
You feeling better?
Injury last week. We'll just leave it at that.
All right. So it hasn't been like the biggest week. There's like a lot of things happening, trade deadlines in baseball, but we start this show like we do every show with our roundup, and we got some gaming news actually.
Yeah, I think the big headline story that kind of hit a bunch of different mainstream news outlets was Booga winning the Fortnite World Cup, specifically the $3 million prize that he took home. Mm-hmm.
A
16-year-old kid?
Yes. I think he's somewhere between 15 and 17, which would be 16, but I think he's around that age, in that age range. But yeah, I thought that was really interesting. Usually these kind of games tend to have these giant prize pools because it's kind of a big thing to get that many people to come out. I think one of the first PUBG tournaments was a big amount. I don't remember the exact dollar amount, but you can hit me up on Twitter if you want to give it to me. But this was, I think, really interesting. This happened in New York.
At Arthur Ashe Stadium.
Yeah, it seemed to have a lot of fanfare, because even when I was there in the city that weekend, I wasn't there for this. I feel like I should have went, but I also kind of don't like Fortnite. I felt like it was just... It seemed to have a really good environment around it. It seemed like a lot of people were really interested in what was going on with Fortnite and how it was being portrayed as a competitive game, because that's kind of always where my interest is mentally as well. But this story that we have kind of is talking about this kid having to deal with now being considered the best Fortnite player in the world, and also being $3 million richer.
Yep. So he's now a celebrity. He's a Twitch streamer, and now he gets stream sniped all the time when he plays.
I don't know if this detail was in here before, but I assume he was probably streaming even before this. Yeah,
he was. Yeah.
Okay.
It's just now that he is the world champion that puts this big target on his back while he plays. And it changes the way he has to play, at least when he's playing. I don't know. Like, you can't really ever say that they're playing casually, because like the game doesn't change whether you're practicing or not. It's the same game. That's kind of one thing about competitive gaming that at least when you're playing individual competitive games versus team ones.
Yeah, because I was going to say, like, the thing with that is when you watch a lot of the Counter-Strike professionals play, because of the way that system is designed for them to play online, they're generally only playing against other professionals. So it tends to come down to how people are feeling, right? Like, you could have guys go in there, and it's usually after, like, a big tournament, and they're just kind of not, and they want to more relax than practice. So you'll see them doing things. They'll joke more. They'll go for weapons that are not, or weapons or strategies that are not conducive to them winning, but would look good to all the stream.
Strategies. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's always, it happens. I don't know how much it happens in Fortnite, because a lot of the people I have watched play aren't the ones who care necessarily about going to these tournaments. They're usually just streamers, which is always that weird separation you have to make in competitive gaming between somebody who plays at a high level just for their stream and who is playing at a high level because they want to compete.
So just to put that prize money in perspective,
yeah,
this tournament occurred at Arthur Ashe Stadium, which is the main court for U.S. Open tennis. The winner of the 2019 U.S. Open tennis tournament will take home $3.8 million. So Booga takes home $3 million, and so this is like it kind of puts into perspective, at least the top of the competitive gaming landscape, like how much money is being thrown around. We've had plenty of stories about like the middle and the bottom, like where you know, that might not be as stable as we might think, but at least when it comes to valuations and the top of these events and the prize money that gets thrown around, we're starting to hit big numbers.
So a question I have is, and once again, I didn't read the full article, so maybe you can give me more detail. Was it just first place takes money? Was it a tiered winning scale where first place gets obviously the biggest amount of money, second place gets something, third place gets something?
It was the latter. I think like all the top winners got something. I want to say the number, like I could be wrong on this, but I found it. It's a $30 million prize pool spread over several different tournaments. So it wasn't just $3 million handed off to one person. And this wasn't like a sweepstakes or a lottery type thing. This was like if you did pretty well, you probably left with something. And
OK.
So Boo wasn't the only person that got anything. $30 million in total thrown around. So that number, I think, was also kind of bandied about. In all the mainstream outlets that were covering this and kind of the oh my god, you can make money playing video games type of stories.
Yeah, it's funny the news outlets that I've seen start to carry this, because it's always interesting when these big things come up. I think one of the other times was during Dota, when Dota kind of hit into the multi-million dollar prize pools, is you saw things like this on like the Today Show or things like that. Or now the what for most people are the big media outlets are these online outlets like Young Turks or Daily Show or things like that, who are now talking about these things and these kids making these giant purses of money, and like what do their parents think, and it's always interesting to see those discussions kind of happen.
Definitely hitting like the cable news financial network type shows, because they now all, you know, when they see that kind of money being thrown around, then like they're talking to their viewers like, hey, this might be an investment opportunity for some of you guys. So,
and speaking of investment opportunities, that kind of takes us into our next story. The Houston Outlaws have been sold for somewhere in the range of $40 million.
Yeah. So the Outlaws, I believe, were owned by Optic Gaming.
Mm-hmm.
And then Optic Gaming was acquired by the Immortals Gaming Club. The Immortals Gaming Club also owns a team in Angeles, I believe. And so because of that, they can't own two teams due to league rules. That would be possible collusion. So they had to sell one. And so they sold the Houston team. And with the $40 million valuation, that kind of whenever a team gets sold like that, the valuation kind of becomes an anchor for future purchases. $40 million definitely demonstrates that that the league is pretty healthy. I believe the buy-in was, I think if we remember right, it was like roughly $20 million to buy into the Overwatch League.
Somewhere around there is definitely correct from what I remember.
Yeah. So if the team's worth around 40 now, then it's kind of a sign that the investment of buying into this league, setting up all of the infrastructure, paying all the players, it's been worth it. The value of the team has grown since then. And will continue to grow. So that's a sign that the league itself is pretty healthy, even if certain owners are being bought out.
Well, yeah, because you want to have a good showing, and I know we've talked about a lot of the struggles money wise for these things, but you things like the Fortnite thing we just talked about, you show the numbers from that. You show the fact that this kid won $3 million. You show you filling up a giant stadium like that for this kind of event. And like you said, with this thing hitting more and more of these financial news branches, people are looking to make bigger investments, right? And we, I think we talked about a story about how a lot of the money right now is coming from investments. And I think if you can kind of keep that shadow up, you can keep doing this until gaming is figured out, in a sense.
Fake it till you make it.
Yeah. Which I'm not always the biggest proponent of, but I think here it kind of helps. Gaming for a long time lived in the shadows of kind of everything else. Even as popular as gaming started to get, it was still looked at as something that, like, you were a weirdo if you spent 1,000 hours getting really good at a video game. And I think I'm kind of glad to see where we are, but I'm waiting for the next step. I really want to get to the next step of a lot of this stuff. Cause it just, I don't know. It just seems awkward in the stages that we're at.
So one thing that can only help with, DJM, points us to, kind of an older story about, I think it was from the New York Times where, was kind of being forced by, or, I don't know
if did we talk about right that because yeah I saw that and I know I wanted us to talk about it, but I don't remember if we ever got around to it. But it was basically we've talked about the idea of the sport parent. Yes. and we've talked about studies that are being done in how that's kind of a bad thing. Forcing your kid to play basketball for 17 hours a day is not great for them, because they're not gaining anything. And now we have these parents who are seeing these dollar amounts and now they're like, okay, well now I want fucking Jimmy to actually play Fortnite for 17 hours a day. And it's like, that's not great. You know, he should want to do it on his own, or just like the forcing of it is just what's partially terrible. But I don't want to dwell on it because we have other things to talk
about. It is a sign of growth when the good things come and the bad things come too. Like, so it's at least an indicator that that this thing is getting big. Yeah. And one other indicator that things are getting big are as esports companies are trying to make more games to further capitalize on the growing landscape. So Riot Games, makers of League of Legends, and I guess now League of Legends Teamfight Tactics, they basically confirmed that they are creating a fighting game as well. They recently acquired the company Radiant, which created the fighting game Rising Thunder, and so their CEO has basically come out and confirmed that, the Evo founder and a Riot employee, Tom Cannon, has basically confirmed they are making a fighting game, and so this will be another competitive avenue for them.
So I found this very interesting, and I'm really glad that we have DJM on the team here because he's kind of the fighting game guy. And we've had these discussions, and then I'm going to give it to DJM here, about how fighting games are kind of always in the background of everything when we talk about esports, and this could potentially be something that brings it to the foreground. But I want to know from a fighting game fan how you feel about possibly Riot, which has also had a lot of bad press lately, now trying to be the forefront of fighting games.
I think it's cool. I generally think it's cool. And the reaction from the fighting game community has been generally positive, especially because it was Riot Games that acquired Radiant, that that started and developed the game Rising Thunder, that had some notable fighting game community people behind it, most notably Seth Killian, noted Street Fighter commentator and community leader. I think that people see Riot Games and know that brand for League of Legends, and they know that it has a lot of backing, and it has developers that appreciate and understand the fighting game genre. So it looks like it could be a good thing. I think more fighting games is always a good thing to the FGC. Mm-hmm. You'll see that with Evo, with how many newer games were on Sunday in the main event, as opposed to like some of the legacy games. And I think that everyone's just kind of excited to see what they'll do. People have always bandied about the idea of, what if you put League of Legends characters into a fighting game? What would it look like? It's an interesting thought. It's an interesting conversation to have. Right now, aside from it being called the worst kept secret in gaming, it's still pretty much up in the air and open. But I think generally the FGC is pretty open-minded about it.
So then that brings two things to mind for me. And one of these is going to be directly directed at you, DGM, and then the other one, JBZ, you can jump in on as well. So the first thing that comes to mind for me is, the one thing I always kind of appreciated about the fighting game community is its kind of homegrownness, and how its talent and things like that kind of rise up from the ranks of these guys who have lived in the community for years when they weren't making money from it, to the point where they are getting paid for their passion. Riot, in its sense of, is all controlling, right? They want to handpick everything. They kind of Disney-fy any of the gaming. Well, they've Disney-fied how they treat League of Legends, right? They don't really care for very showy personality much anymore. Everything kind of has to be, in a sense, cookie cutter. And they don't necessarily go for, like, there's always the stories of how they force the players to take media courses and do all these things and stuff like that. That seems like something that's going to clash with how the fighting game community kind of tends to be.
I think that's an interesting point. However, at the same time, if they are making a fighting game with people that understand the community, I think they will understand that you can have a balance. You can have something where you are controlling your game's brand while also highlighting your charismatic and outgoing players and performers. I think that's something that the FGC does better than any competitive gaming world, that they are not afraid to highlight their individual stars, because it is an individual sport, like tennis, like MMA. It is a sport of individuals rather than teams. And I think that Riot probably gets that. I think that when the time comes that whatever fighting game they are making is ready for Evo, they understand that it will be part of a collection of championship game tournaments. Can they be like Nintendo with Super Smash Brothers and run their own individual tournaments, like with Capcom and the Tekken World Tour? Absolutely. They can have their own.
Oh, I'm sure absolutely. That's what they're... because that was kind of be the other thing I was going to ask.
They can absolutely have their own.
There's no way in hell Riot is going to want to stay like second, third fiddle at a community tournament. They're going to want to have their own arena. They're going to want to have their own shit that seems separate from everyone else.
If they want fighting game and fans and fighting game players to play their games, they're going to have to accept that, yeah, people will play their game, but they will probably play Street Fighter 2. They'll play their game. They might play Samurai Showdown, which has blown up on the scene just in the last year. That's what the fighting game community is. Everyone that is a specialist probably plays at least one other game just for fun or just to have that skill level.
I'm trying to figure out how to word this. Like, I think they've learned from their own mistakes in a sense, because they're on to making new ones, but that's beside the point. Because they did used to have contracts where they told their players, you can't play anything else. You can only play League of Legends.
Well, then I don't think that's in the contracts
anymore.
Say,
I don't think it's in the contracts anymore, but
if I get really good at this game in a couple of years, but I'm also like a high level competitive Street Fighter player,
yeah,
either you pay me a ton of money or we're gonna have to work something out, because I make money playing Street Fighter too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I would think that because of the people they have involved with what this game is going to be, they have one of the founders of the biggest fighting game tournament in the world on their payroll. They have to have some kind of understanding of this. Like, even Nintendo bent eventually.
I would hope so.
Nintendo bent to the community eventually and were like, yes, okay, you can have the games at other tournaments. Even recently, Toei Animation with Dragon Ball FighterZ, there was a problem with Dragon Ball FighterZ being at other events that were community events until, mm-hmm. yeah, they ended up on Evo. They ended up on Saturday. But, yeah, it's called the fighting game community, emphasis on that third word, for a reason.
Yeah, and I think Riot... I want to believe that they see the importance of branching out, because they're one of the companies that I guess I always worried about, because, that Dota is a big competitive game, but Valve doesn't rely on Dota for income. Valve relies on being the premier platform for buying and downloading PC games. Blizzard has... StarCraft and Overwatch League now, and for a while the Heroes of the Storm esports, and so they could, they didn't have all their eggs in one basket.
Like, even with StarCraft, for the longest time, and even more now because their primary focus is Overwatch League, StarCraft is run by its community. It's more just has the blessing of Blizzard than anything else, but the community is what drives StarCraft in Korea.
Yeah, and so I guess Blizzard has kind of learned, it sounds like Blizzard has learned, maybe even the hard way, that they can't force that community to do, to fit into their bubble.
Which is the same thing Nintendo learned, and it's the same thing Toei learned. And if Riot wants to test this, they'll learn it too. They have to be more like Bandai Namco with Tekken and Capcom with Street Fighter and Marvel. They have to learn to embrace the community, embrace the fan base, and embrace the competitive scene as it is.
Yeah. And I think, if anything, that'll just help them grow, because A, they won't alienate the community, and B, they can get big personality players that are playing other games to come play their game and potentially get good at their game too. So like you guys said, it's very personality driven, very individual driven. So instead of having to create your new individuals from scratch, take advantage of the ones that are there and use them to help make your game more popular, so that you're not relying on League of Legends to carry you forward. And if one day people stop playing League of Legends, then like, what else do you have to make money off of? Now they have a fighting game, and so hopefully they don't make the same mistakes. They are friendly to the community, and they choose to help that grow. Okay, so speaking of Evo, DJM, how did the Evo tournament play out?
Evo this weekend, last weekend in Las Vegas, was pretty fun, as always. There were some great finals, some great matches. big news coming out of the Tekken Championship, Arslan Ash, a player from Pakistan who's been on an absolute tear all of 2019, won EVO, being the first player from Pakistan to win a major championship, beating Ni, generally regarded by many as the greatest Tekken player ever. And he's still the current world ranking number one in the grand finals. Sonic Fox, the famous Sonic Fox, went 1-for-2 in his EVO Grand Finals. Both of these tournaments had nearly 2,000 competitors, as did Tekken. Nearly 2,000 competitors all registered and competed. And Sonic Fox, the juggernaut that he is, who only just recently turned 21, by the way, went 1-for-2. Placing second in Dragon Ball FighterZ to Goichi, his rival over the last couple of years. They've been going back and forth, a la Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal in the last couple of years. Goichi just has an impenetrable defensive game in Dragon Ball FighterZ, and it was something to watch. Just the art of blocking in fighting games was just phenomenal. And Sonic Fox won MK11, because of course he does. When it comes to the NetherRealm Studios games, Sonic Fox is, as I've said before, he is the New England Patriots. He is the Alabama Crimson Tide as far as the NetherRealm games. It's been that way since MK9, the Injustice games, MKX, and MK11. He continues to dominate, and placing second in Dragon Ball FighterZ, which he won, I believe, in 2018. I believe he actually did beat Goichi in 2018. So those two now are 1-1 in Evolution Grand Finals. So also Samurai Showdown, having a big show for being a game that just came out. Really good showing. And yeah, it was another fun weekend of the biggest fighting game tournament at the Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas.
So when you mention a guy like Sonic Fox, that's the kind of personality that I'm talking about for Riot, that like they need to attract this kind of high level player, because Dragon Ball FighterZ is kind of a fairly new game, right? Came out within the last couple of years, and it's already got one of the best players in the game, in fighting games,
several.
Playing very, very well at it. So that's, that's how you put your game on the map, is to get guys like that to come in and play your game and dominate at it. And
it can also be in the case of someone like Arslan Ash, who really just came out of nowhere, at least globally. I imagine in Pakistan he was pretty well known, but yeah, somebody like that. That's kind of the cool thing about the FGC, is that it can be in an open invitational of 2,000 players, one player coming and shocking the world. That's an exciting story all its own. But yeah, you can have Sonic Fox, you can have a Daigo, those kinds of names and guys playing your game. You can have a Justin Long. And yeah, that definitely helps too. But if you are able to build a community around your game, there will be people that will come out of it that will be unique to them. And at the end of the day, people still know Sonic Fox for playing Mortal Kombat and the Injustice games. He is a NetherRealm game player. And if Riot is fortunate enough to have one or two guys come out of this game that they're developing, that's all the better for everyone.
Yeah. Like Bugo with Fortnite. All right. So let's move on to the physical sports realm. Just finish up the roundup. As far as basketball news goes, no transactional news. So I guess, the off season is kind of, it's not over, but at least the big signings, nobody else important has signed with a new team or has been traded. Chris Paul is stuck where he is. So that's all for that. As far as broadcasting news, Twitch has reached a streaming deal with USA Basketball. So that's pretty cool. And this is for both the men's and women's team, and also the junior global championship. So there's going to be a lot of games that were previously kind of hard to find on TV, or you know, not broadcasted at all, that are now going to be broadcast on Twitch. So the NBA has already had a pretty successful partnership broadcasting the G League on Twitch. So I think they're kind of, even though this isn't specifically the NBA, this is USA Basketball as a whole, but they're kind of expanding that. And, you know, between the G League and 2K League and USA Basketball, that's a lot of basketball content that is now being broadcast on Twitch.
Yeah.
Twitch, and good for basketball in general.
Yeah, no, I think this is definitely going to be a very interesting thing, but it's odd to see Twitch taking this dive for sports. They made the deal with the NFL. Now they have this deal with the NBA. I would love to see if somehow, some way, they're able to make a deal with baseball. That'll definitely be the one that surprises me if they're able to make that. And then I think you just finish the round out and go for hockey. I don't even think that's hard. There might already be hockey on Twitch, just no one knows or cares.
I think they should go straight for hockey, because I think hockey might be at that level where they would benefit from having a significantly wider audience, just because everybody who watches hockey doesn't hate the fact that they watched hockey. Like, it's, nobody has a bad experience watching hockey. So if you put it in front of more people, that can only help. It's harder to find right now. Like, you got to go to your regional sports network. It's just not that popular. It's not a mainstay on ESPN. You know, like, you don't see highlights that often on SportsCenter for it. So, like, yeah, just put it in front of more people. So, yeah, I would definitely like to see Twitch head in that direction. But as far as more basketball news goes, the NBA, we had previously talked about some of their efforts with mental health and they're kind of formalizing all of that. I think we had speculated previously on what that might mean for each on a team by team basis, and we're starting to see that. They're basically going to require that every team has their own mental health professional on staff, 1 to 2 people on staff, and then that'll be somebody that, you know, anybody who is who's suffering from mental health issues can go talk to that person. They don't have to go, you know, out and find their own doctor. So I think it's good to see them take this more seriously. I would actually like to see them expand this a little bit more, just because I think this person on staff to me sounds like more of a counselor, even though they'll be totally certified and everything. But it almost feels like when you have one person that is supposed to cover the health of 15 people, then it kind of becomes tricky, because like, what happens if multiple people on the team are like involved in some issue, like some spat with each other, and you know, and they want to talk about it, but one person is hearing all of these, all of the concerns from all these different people, and they have to, you know, they have to come up with treatment, for an individual person one at a time. But having heard what other people have said, I feel like every player should have their own personal professional, but you know, I understand if the league does not want to make that investment to have like 15 mental health people on staff.
What if you have something like this as a kind of a branching thing, right? You have this person that everybody is required to go talk to, this person may, you know, gives them kind of a base mental checkpoint, just to kind of see where they are, and then makes a determination with like maybe a small two to five person team, whether that person needs more evaluation or is in a good, you know, place mentally, or maybe, you know, needs to seek some recourse of therapy. So then when you have your tiers, you can be like, cool, this is the evaluation we give you. We feel like you should seek out therapy. And then it is on that person from there to make arrangements with this team to help them to go seek out a therapist where they feel comfortable doing so. Whereas that way it's no longer connected to the team, but make it so that staff that is there has some kind of push or leeway to it, but not put somebody on staff. Like not, you know, for each team player on staff kind of thing, but you make like a really small team that does these evaluations for players, and then make suggestions based on their evaluation. But they're maybe governed more by the NBA rather than the team, but they work for the team, right? The NBA is like, look, these people are on staff. You pay them. This is what they're here to do. But they don't answer to you. So if they tell you, like, hey, this guy needs to do this, and we think these are the best recourses, these are the best things for him to do, then it kind of carries out from there, if any of that made sense.
It's kind of like the privacy is always going to be a concern, because players are going to be reluctant to volunteer any information to these people if they think it's going to make it if the team is going to find out, because they're concerned about playing time, they're concerned about losing their job if there's this perception that they that they're not mentally tough, then they're afraid that, you know, that's going to affect their standing with the coaches and all that. So they have to be very careful. Teams have to be very careful about how they guarantee players' privacy. It's, you know, and one of the things that you said earlier made sense to me, that like they should force everybody to at least talk to this person. That way it doesn't become a sort of thing where like, oh, nobody sought help from this person except for this one particular player. And then that player gets singled out. So, so they have to be very careful about how they handle that. I mean, I guess this is a good first step, and we'll see where this ends up leading. I guess moving on to the NFL, training camp and preseason have started, and that kind of brings us into our lead story for this week, which is all things Antonio Brown.
All right.
So just a little bit of background. Antonio Brown, one of the best receivers in the NFL. He kind of acted out when he was with the Pittsburgh Steelers, and that caused them to trade him this offseason for a third round and a fifth round pick to the Raiders. So kind of a cheap trade for it was a trade that made it very clear that they just wanted to get rid of him. So I think that was kind of some of the first red flags, as far as like there might be, you know, some bigger issues with this person. As part of this trade, Brown got, you know, a $30 million guaranteed contract. He got to renegotiate his contract and all that. So he made out big with all this. The Raiders got what they thought was kind of a steal, getting, you know, like the top two receivers in the NFL for just a third round and a fifth round pick. But now training camp has started, and he's missed a lot of training camp. One of the reasons why he's missed some time is because he has frostbite on his feet. this is something that he got from doing this this treatment. What I would call an unproven treatment, whole body cryotherapy, where it's supposed to be similar to like an ice bath, except really quick. And so you go into a room.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of this treatment pandied about in bodybuilding circles for faster, like you said, for faster recycle time on the muscles and things like that. But I have not seen a lot of studies about it that give any large credences to it. And everything I seem to see and read seems very like micro, like kind of like, oh yeah, like in the percentage is like 0.2, 0.3s rather than like some giant number that would make it seem amazing.
Yeah, I mean, if it was, then I feel like you would see a lot more athletes try to do this. But this is like I guess you can kind of see where somebody made the mental leaps to get from laying in an ice bath to standing in a minus 100 degree room for 2 to 3 minutes while liquid nitrogen and refrigerated air is blasting at you. But yeah, he basically went into one of those rooms and didn't wear the proper footwear, so now he's got frostbite on his feet. And
that's it's not like, the only thing that's going on with him?
Yeah. If anything, the Raiders are kind of saying that that's kind of the less serious issue. And I guess when frostbite is... Like, when I hear frostbite, I think, like, oh, shit, like, he's going to have his feet amputated.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't think it's that bad. And I don't think the Raiders think it's that bad either. They say it's mostly a non-issue. The big issue with Antonio Brown right now is his helmet. And you'd wonder why that would be an issue, because, you know, players and teams kind of have, like, standardized helmets. There are 34 different helmet models to choose from. They have like various shapes, they have various face mask arrangements. Antonio Brown is very, very attached to his old helmet, the Shut Air Advantage model. That version is older than 10 years. So every helmet that NFL players use has to be certified by the National Operating Committee for Standards and Athletic Equipment. And they basically stop testing gear after 10 years, or after it's been out on the market for 10 years. And I think that's kind of just like, oh, it's old equipment, so we don't really need to test this anymore. And you can assume that the newer equipment is safer. So that's kind of their reason for doing that. Antonio Brown is having none of that. And he basically believes that like all of the new styles of helmets, they kind of like protrude a little bit too far into his vision. So I guess for a wide receiver, that makes, you know, that has an effect that like if you have a harder time seeing the ball, then you have a harder time catching the ball. So he sounds like he's willing to die on this hill. Because he's gone so far as to take his old Steelers helmet and paint it in Raiders colors and try to sneak onto the practice field with it. So that's how strongly he feels about this helmet thing. He's filed a grievance with the NFL. There are reports that he is threatening to retire if he doesn't get to go back to his old helmet. He's arguing that, you know, that deciding to stop testing these helmets after 10 years is kind of arbitrary, that, you know, and in a way I can kind of see his point. 'Cause like, you know, if this helmet is 9 years old, it's good. If it's 10 years old, it's bad. DJM says like, normally when a receiver like has like diva like behavior, which is very common among wide receivers for some reason, it's usually like ego driven that like, oh, the quarterback needs to throw me the ball. Like he needs, like, it's me, throw me the ball, get me the ball. I want to be the star of the show. And in this case, it's not really that at all. It's a very practical reason. It's a reason driven by safety and equipment and just personal preference of how he wants to play the game. I mean, some of it may be superstitious. Yeah. People like to cling to the equipment that works well for them. But I mean, if he's claiming that this is going to affect his vision on the field,
to file a grievance and to threaten to retire and all these other things that he's doing. I mean, is this the hill you die on?
Right. And that's kind of the question that everybody is asking right now. Like, is he really willing to do that? Because I mean, that's specifically why I mentioned that $30 million guaranteed contract. It's quote unquote guaranteed. It's still contingent on him, like, you know, at least starting to get out on the field and play. If he straight up retires, then he does have to forfeit that money. So it's that's a lot of money to walk away from over a helmet, over a helmet style. There are, like I said, there are 34 different newer certified styles that he can choose from, and he just likes none of those. He just wants to go back to his old safety blanket helmet.
I can understand in a sense of like something works and you feel like it keeps you safe, and now they're telling you this new thing is going to keep you as safe and work just as well, and you're like, I don't know.
It's probably at least a little bit uncomfortable for him. I mean, maybe just because it's different and he hasn't taken the time to get used to it. But it's such a weird line to draw in the sand. He's threatened to hold the league liable if he were to play with the new helmet or a helmet that they forced him to wear, and he sustained a head injury from that. But at the same time, I also see the league's perspective that, like, even if Brown were to like waive the right to sue the league if he got injured in his old helmet, then I think there's still, like, the league still has a perception problem around concussions and safety. And so if a player were to try to circumvent that, even if they assumed all liability on themselves, like if they got hurt, when a player gets hurt, it still reflects poorly on the NFL. So I can kind of see the NFL's perspective that they don't want to make exceptions to this. You know, even if it is, you know, one of the best players in the league, I think this fight is too important and too big for them to make an exception on just for one player. Because then, you know, if you do it for Antonio Brown, then you have to allow other players to sign waivers and circumvent these rules. And then if those players start getting hurt, then the NFL is the one that takes the perception hit, not those players. Long term, and we already have issues with, like, are you going to let your kids play football? Is it safe enough? And so, I think all of that is a part of all of this.
Yeah, no, I agree as well. But I think
also the Raiders are on Hard Knocks this year, so
all this is going to be aired out.
Yeah, possibly, whether they choose to cut it or not. But I hope they don't choose to cut it.
All right, let's move on to some ends and some odds. We got this story about DJ Cooper and his awful cheating efforts. What's the deal here?
So DJ Cooper is an American basketball player, no relation to Kaz.
no relation.
He's also, I guess he has Bosnian heritage. So So he was trying to make the Bosnian national team as a naturalized player. So as part of that, you gotta do drug tests. So apparently this actually happened in 2018, but he hasn't been playing since then. And now we've found out why. And it's the fact that when he submitted his own urine for that drug test, the tests came back with the presence of GHC, which is a hormone produced by the placenta when a woman is pregnant. So DJ Cooper is not a woman. DJ Cooper is not pregnant. That was basically a very, very clear signal to FIBA that DJ Cooper submitted somebody else's urine for this test. An obvious cheating effort and a downright insulting cheating effort. And so they basically
that's a lack of effort right there. Like,
I feel like you get like a year penalty for the cheating, and then like an extra year for the bad effort. It's insulting to think that they wouldn't catch something like that. Like if you're gonna cheat, you gotta try harder. That's.
Maybe that is now how he found out his girlfriend is pregnant.
The stated reason for taking a break from basketball was family reasons. So I don't know, but what do you think? DJ Cooper is not playing basketball anymore, and he will forever be linked as the guy who got caught being pregnant on a drug test.
That's good right there. I don't care who you are. All right, let's move on to the next one. We got a fight canceled due to a hotel mishap.
So this one is not the athlete's fault this time. Carl Frampton, former featherweight world champion boxer. Hands are important in this case. He was scheduled. He had recently lost the world championship, and so he's kind of having his comeback fight against Emmanuel Dominguez scheduled for a couple weekends ago in Philadelphia.
I saw a lot of advertisements for it, so this was like kind of a really hyped up fight.
Yeah, and it didn't happen. And the reason it didn't happen was because he was sitting in the hotel lobby and a concrete column, like a decorative concrete column, fell on his hand.
This
isn't like some, like, you know, this was a big heavy thing. It like smashed the table that it fell on.
Oh my god.
So it broke the fifth metacarpal in his left hand, which is the bone that connects your wrist to pinky knuckle. So if he were to resume, if he were to try to fight with that, then basically every time his left hand gets hit, he's going to feel like pain is going to shoot down his arm every single time. So that is a really, really tough injury for a boxer to sustain. So not only did they have to cancel that fight, he's now going to have to, you know, go through the process recovering. I don't know if it was a full break. I think it was just a fracture, but still, it's going to take a while to recover from that. This isn't the first time that he's had a fight called off from a bizarre injury. It's the last time it wasn't his injury. It was his opponent, Andres Gutierrez, who fell in the shower and knocked himself out, losing a pair of teeth.
How do you lose a fight to a shower?
Look, I've been there.
You've knocked yourself out in a
footwork. Cass,
knocked myself
footwork.
Out, but I have
footwork.
Yeah, I have fallen in the shower. I got stitches on my chin for that. So if that happened to me right before a fight, then I don't think I would go through with the fight.
No. I'm not giving him shit for not going through with the fight. I'm just giving him shit for being a boxer and losing a fight to a shower.
Yeah, that's fair.
The tile. You lost a tile.
Footwork. Needs work.
No footwork, slippery.
Gotta work on those feet.
That's step one in the fight game. That's step one.
Step one in any sport, except for competitive gaming.
Depends. You never know. You're right. You might be a race car.
You might be a DDR player.
Might be a DDR player. All right. So last but not least, we're going to talk about kind of, I think, the most well-known mascot in sports, the Philly Fanatic.
Yeah. And Philly Fanatic is somebody that's kind of close to my heart because the first sport that I ever did watch was baseball. And this happened around the time when I had moved to Pennsylvania in the Philadelphia suburbs for like a year. So the team that I saw on TV was the Philadelphia Phillies. And I was like 6 years old. I didn't know anything about baseball, but I saw this big green looking thing like running across the field. And that's it, like the Philly Fanatic might be one of my earliest sports memories, period. And now I'm reading stories that he might be a free agent, which I didn't know could be a thing. Like, I thought mascots were just like created by the team, owned by the team. Like they were always symbolic of the team, but no, actually the Philly Fanatic
I passionately want this to be covered like it would be any big time free agent in sports. I want it to be talked about on First Take. I want interviews with the agent. I want ESPN or whoever to get insight from like Drew Rosenhaus and all of the big names, Scott Boras and the like. I want this to just get fully covered all the way because this has potential to be such great theater of the absurd, and I want it.
Yeah.
Once this all happens, Ken Rosenthal is going to break the story on Twitter. So this comes down to Harrison Erickson Incorporated is the company that they worked with the Philadelphia Phillies to kind of create the Philly Fanatic, the likeness, the design of it. And they've done that for other, you know, mascot slash costume type things. I think they did some work with the Muppets as well, which kind of makes sense when you look at the Philly Fanatic and just like the fact that he's not representative of like an animal or anything. Like you look at him and like I can't even describe in words what he is supposed to represent. He's just this big green thing in a suit that like kind of Big Bird sized, you know, with this weird looking snout. It's a weird, unique design. So that was created in the late 1970s. I think it kind of licensed to the team, I guess you could say. And so several times they renegotiated that licensing deal until 1984, which was the last renegotiation. The Phillies argue that at that point, the Harrison Erickson Incorporated gave up the rights to the Fanatic, but HE believes that they haven't, and they want to renegotiate that deal, and they're threatening to take the Philly Fanatic's talents elsewhere if they don't get a renegotiation. So I mean, they could, if they really wanted to, like play this out in really, really embarrassing fashion, like actually have the Philly Fanatic go around and you know, put on gear and root for other teams. I don't know if they have any legal basis for this, but they could make this really, really embarrassing for the Phillies. That's exactly what DJM wants. So
it's so weird though. Like it's really weird to go through this much. Like Because one, right, like I love the idea of the fanfare of it, but one, my biggest thing is, what team comes along and goes, yeah, like, I mean,
I think have to be a division rival, right?
To
come in and be like, okay, I am going to embarrass my division rival. But at the same time, there's also like, there's also kind of, I don't want to say like a gentleman's agreement among owners, but like, I think they in general try not to embarrass each other but like all it really takes is one owner to be like, you know, like fuck the unwritten rules and I'm just gonna like I see an opportunity here and I'm gonna capitalize on this.
DJM wants it to be the Dodgers and Magic Johnson. he wants ESPN reports of the Fanatic flying out to LA to meet with the Dodgers and Magic Johnson.
Yeah, this has so much potential to be.
It's so awkward. It's so fucking awkward. But I think one of the things is, and someone please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think like a lot of baseball mascots, a lot of baseball mascots specifically, kind of more came out of the history of the team rather than a meeting and a decision. I think there's a lot of things that, I think a lot of teams for a lot of time had physical people as representations of their fandom, and then like kind of from there created things. I don't think it's much the way of basketball or football in a sense, where it is kind of a well thought out and designed and then owned by the team thing. Because just the odd history of baseball and how long it's been around, I think some things have just come out of history as opposed to a creative meeting.
Yeah, and the Philly Fanatic is kind of like he's iconic as a Philly mascot, but also iconic just on its own as like a real loose cannon of a mascot. Like he's injured a couple people. He's like shot people in the face. Like you can scroll down in this Deadspin article, and one of the links is Philly Fanatic shoots woman in face with a hot dog gun, sends her to the hospital. in terms of like mascot behavior, he's more along the lines of a college mascot than what you would expect.
A major league, you know, just out there for photo ops and then maybe throw some t-shirts into the crowd.
Yeah, as like a family outing. And in a way, Philly mascots
I think the weird thing also is baseball mascots are generally more involved. Like they have the whole race. They have like the fights between mascots and like all these things are baseball things, but I think just in general baseball mascots are more involved with entertaining the crowd and doing those kind of things than mascots of any other sport. Like baseball has a little bit of stuff, but like I mean basketball has a little bit of stuff, but baseball is like the mascot really does a lot of shit.
And as DJM says, like maybe that's because the game itself is a bit calmer. So like you kind of need the mascot to kind of go out and do wild shit. I don't know. I feel like no mascot has exemplified that any more than the Philly Fanatic has. I didn't recognize that as a baseball thing. I thought that was just a Philly thing because they also have Gritty, the mascot for the Philadelphia Flyers, who is basically taken the NHL by storm to the point where I think Gritty might actually be more popular than the NHL itself. So it's, you know, part of it is a Philadelphia thing. Just Philadelphia fans are pretty wild in general. I think part of it is, and I think the Philly Fanatic exemplifies that. And so to see him go to any other team, even as just like a joke, that would be pretty weird and pretty embarrassing for the Phillies. If they decide like, oh, you can leave and we'll come up with our new mascot, come up with something else. Like, nobody's going to accept that.
No. Like, that's the big thing is no one's like even if you have the biggest asshole owner who takes that and he's like, cool, I'm going to take the Philly Fanatic and we'll call him like DJM says, the Phoenix Fanatic. No fan is going to be like, I'm cool with this. There will be some people, but like most people are just going to be like, this is awkward.
But could be funny. So awkward, but could be funny is basically a hallmark of our show. So thank you guys for continuing to listen to Sports Odds and Ends. Head on over to sportsoddsandends.com to find links to these stories and the rest of the show notes. If you want to chime in on Twitter, I'm at JVZ. Kaz is at King Kaz. DJM is at Call Me DJM. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you guys next week.